So for those of you who were here last week when I was here, I'd like to pick up a thread from last week and pursue it. I think one of the mistakes that we make in our tradition, I'm not sure how we do it, it's kind of unspoken, but it gets across to people, is when people think of our spiritual practice, they think of doing meditation practice. And that's a very important component of our practice, but actually there's a lot more to it. You know, there's nothing outside our practice, nothing at all. So I'd like to really talk about some of the ways in which we can approach practice, not just through meditation. And I'd like to start by offering a couple of different contradicting ways of approaching reality. And the first comes from a beloved character for me, Calvin. That's not John Calvin, it's Calvin. So at some point we're in Calvin's mind, and he's daydreaming about the Jurassic. And there's correct me, those of you who know dinosaurs, but there's a pterodactyl who's flying through the air and seems to be quite content in the world. And then at some point some giant dinosaur comes leaping up out of the water to snatch the pterodactyl. And at that moment, there's the voice, Calvin, pay attention. So Calvin looks up, and Miss Wormwood is standing over him with her fists on her hips. And she's saying, we're studying geography. What state are you in? And he looks up and says, denial. And this word just walks away, shaking her head and saying, you can't argue with that. actually, if you follow Calvin as I have, over the years, Calvin developed a very subtle and sophisticated philosophy of denial. I don't want to try to go too deeply into it, but I recommend reading him. So that's one approach to reality, denial. And I think if we're honest with ourselves and with each other, we choose that a lot. We'd rather not know about unpleasant things, about ourselves, about the people around us, about the world. It's just a lot easier if we don't know. And Calvin's very eloquent about that. So the alternative, the vision of working with our experience that really contradicts Calvin comes from the Buddha, who we might call his philosophy the philosophy of realism. Instead of turning away, instead of being in a state of denial, we're actually in a state of consciousness. We try to be in a state of consciousness. We actually try to know what is real. And that includes not only what is pleasant and real, but also what is unpleasant and real. And the reason that that's important, it goes back to what I was saying when I was offering instructions for the meditation practice. The Buddha's understanding that our minds are responsible for our happiness or our suffering, not our circumstance. It's our minds. And if we master our minds, no matter what our circumstances are, if we master our minds, we can have an unshakable happiness. And in order to master our minds in that way, we have to be willing to deal with all of reality. It's not easy. T.S. Eliot, in one point in the Four Quartets, T.S. Eliot says, humanity cannot bear very much reality. And that may be true, actually. And so we actually can come to bear more and more reality if we practice it, if we work at it, if we train ourselves to be willing to turn toward what is real instead of turning away from it. And so one of the practices that we have in this particular tradition that helps us to turn toward what is real are the five daily recollections. I'm going to share four of them. I'll leave it to you to look up to see what's the fifth. But these recollections is actually really useful to do these reflections or to reflect on this every day. And it's the kind of reflection that most people are not even interested in touching with a 10-foot pole. So the first of the five daily recollections is, I am of the nature to grow old. I cannot avoid growing old. Instead of turning away from this, I turn toward it and deal with it. So the Buddha said, when he realized that he would grow old, that he lost the arrogance of youth. And the second reflection is, I am of the nature to get sick. I cannot avoid getting sick. And the Buddha said, when he realized that he would get sick, he lost the arrogance of health. And the third of these five recollections, I am of the nature to die. There is no way I can avoid death. And the Buddha said, when he came to understand that he would die, he lost the arrogance of life. These are not normally the things we like to deal with, but every one of those things is true. I talked some about that last week. If you live long enough, you'll get old. And it's a hard journey, getting old, actually. And you can either resist that, or you can face it. What I was saying earlier, that it's really our minds that create our pain and our suffering, and as well as our happiness. If we hate getting old and we resist it, and we hate and resist all of the manifestations of aging, we're going to suffer. If we can let go of that resistance, that's not such a big deal. That's simple. You know, if we hate getting sick, I talked about that last week. You know, how can we practice in such a way that we don't have to create suffering for ourselves in the midst of an epidemic? Because a lot of us are going to be vomiting and having diarrhea, and if it hasn't happened already, with the swine flu and the fever, and some of us will die. We don't have to suffer. If we understand that resistance is suffering, it's not what's happening to us, it's our resistance to it that is causing our suffering, it's possible to let that resistance go. Then, you know, getting sick is not such a big deal. And if we understand that we must die, every one of us, we're running at 100% now for humans, you know, if we know that we have to die, if we feel that we hate that and we don't want it to happen and we cling to life, then we'll suffer. If we understand that this is just reality and we let the resistance go, then dying is not a big deal. And then the fourth of these recollections, which for me is the most poignant and actually for me the most difficult, all that is dear to me and everyone that I love is of the nature to change. There is no way I can avoid being separated from them. Everything that is important to us and everyone we love, we will lose. It is simply the nature of this life. You know, we just don't want to know about these things, but there is something magical and powerful about turning toward these things and facing them that actually leads to happiness. So it's a choice. It's a choice that we can make. Do we choose to turn toward the fact that we're going to get old? Can we turn toward the fact that we're going to get sick? Can we turn toward the fact that we're going to die? And if we let the resistance go, it's possible to do all of those things with a pretty stable happiness and equanimity. That's the magic of this practice. So but there are other challenges that come to us in our lives besides getting old and getting sick and dying. I'm just wondering if we can actually be willing to turn toward other difficulties that happen in our lives. You know, every one of us, if we live long enough, will have difficult and challenging circumstances in our lives. How do we deal with them? If you're on a path of freedom, if you're on a path of transformation, it's very beautiful that any challenge that comes up is something that can be used. And in our attitude, our stance toward what is happening really can be very different. Instead of feeling that we're faced with an ordeal, we can see that, oh, we're faced with an opportunity. And I'd just like to share just some examples of things that I've heard about quite recently of people facing very difficult circumstances and being willing to use them either for their own benefit in terms of transforming themselves or for the benefit of others. Just two examples of people I have known in the last few weeks who have made a very important choice. Many of us in this community know Kathleen O'Malley, who's part of the Sangha. And Kathleen has, for many years now, has been going to the places of terrible conflict and being a witness of what is happening in a way of trying to bring peace to the situation. So Kathleen has been in Palestine, and she has been at least twice or maybe three times in Iraq. She's been in Iran. And she has either left this week or is about to leave this week to go back to Iraq. She is choosing to go into conflict situations, where there's enormous suffering in order to try to bring happiness and peace and healing to the situation. I just really honor what she's done. I've sort of watched her process for several years now. That's one example. And a similar example is another person that I know in southern Colorado, in Mancos, southern Colorado, who's been a psychotherapist for many years in a private practice. And in her early 60s, she has just decided, someone who lives alone, she has just decided that she's been observing so many veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan with post-traumatic stress disorder, people who have been badly wounded emotionally by their experience of war. And she has just made this decision that she's going to devote her time now to trying to help returning veterans heal their trauma. And so she's gotten together with a team of people, and they're doing equine therapy. So that returning soldiers who might be so wounded that they can't really relate to people very well can relate to a horse. And through that, to begin a healing process. See another person who's willing to turn toward this pain and engage this pain in order to be helpful to living beings, helping people to heal. So it can be a voluntary act like that, but sometimes it can be an involuntary act. And I'd like to, if I may, share with you another example of something that I've just encountered in the last week. It goes back about 2.5 years ago. A pedestrian in Santa Fe was killed by a drunk driver. And the driver drove away from the scene and was eventually found by the police wandering outside of his car. He's now in the prison in Springer, New Mexico, and a good friend of the person who was killed decided quite early on in the process of this person being in jail and going on trial and going to prison, decided to contact him to see if she could somehow bring healing reconciliation between him and the family of the woman he killed. So far, no luck. But she did ask me some months ago, she said, will you go to the prison and meet with him? And I said, tell me about him, you know. That's a lot of hours. In my mind, I was thinking, is it worth it? You know, what kind of person is this? And I heard a very touching story about someone who fought in the first Gulf War in 1991 at the age of 18 and saw terrible things and came back with very severe post-traumatic stress disorder. Was disabled and was living on disability and decided that instead of collecting his disability checks and wandering the streets, that he would actually do something with his life. So he went off to college and got a degree in social worker. Thank you. Worked as a social worker and was working in Santa Fe, actually helping children who were very ill, helping them to get lung transplants and liver transplants, and was actually doing a lot of good, and started a master's program. And what he had learned was that there were various ways that he could manage the post-traumatic stress disorder, which was very severe, and one of them was alcohol. And he had just met a girlfriend and had really connected to her, and he said, you know, I really want to get off this alcohol. She went off to Europe, and while she was away, he drank more and was, you know, just forming a life, trying to move out of all the trauma when he killed someone. What happened was he hit this pedestrian and he went into a post-traumatic state and was wandering around dissociated. That was one reason why he left the scene of the crime. His girlfriend said, you're a good guy, I'm going to stick by you, and they married and had a child about a year ago. So this is kind of the background, and so I go to Springer last Sunday to the prison. I'm not sure what I was going to find, but what I found actually was a person who was very open, very honest, really interested in getting whatever information I could give him, who is very perceptive, and essentially one of the first things I said to him, okay, your circumstances are really difficult here. You've killed someone, you're in prison for it. This is not a very good place to be, this prison. You have a choice. You know, you can either go through this process and get into deeper and deeper bitterness and anger, and come out wound even tighter with those feelings. Or you can take this opportunity of this very challenging situation and turn things around. He said, I really want to turn things around. He said, I want to go to work in a VA hospital and I want to work with returning soldiers with post-traumatic stress disorder, and I want to work with people who have substance abuse. And so it was a very interesting thing to be working with this person who didn't choose those circumstances. And he chose to, and he was very interested in, tell me about karma, tell me about karma. What is my responsibility here? How does this work? Really trying to understand his situation and really taking, he had been interested in Buddhism before. He now has a passion for doing meditation practice and has started a sitting group in the prison. So it was very, very interesting. So if we are living a life of denial, there's some way in which we can turn away from our pain and keep turning away from our pain. This is someone who made a choice right after the Gulf War to turn toward his pain and work with a post-traumatic stress disorder and turn toward the pain of others, and is really using this very painful situation. And one of the things he asked me just before I left, he said he's coming out on appeal probably in January. And we'll go through a period of months of appeal and either go back to prison or if his appeal succeeds, he'll be free. He'll be coming to Albuquerque, and he said, is there anyone I can sit with? And I said, yeah, there's a really good sangha there. That's why I haven't told you his name. You know, because he may be sitting among you, you know, within the next couple of months. And thanks heavens, I can recommend you. Someone who wants to take their situation and turn it around, transform their situation, is taking the difficulty and using it. And this is the choice that we can make in our lives. We can do the denial thing. I recommend Calvin. or we can do the Buddha thing, which is really to become... Well, I don't know. I read Calvin as much as I read Buddha. So. And I'd like to suggest, and I'll be brief here, but I'd like to suggest one other way that we can turn toward what is challenging for us in our lives rather than turning away, and actually use it. Use it for our practice. Use it for our transformation. And I take as my inspiration a line from my teacher, Joseph Goldstein, who once said, in spiritual practice, family is the final exam. Does that ring a bell with anybody? You know, there's some way that the most intimate people in our lives are the ones who push our buttons most deeply. So the holidays are coming up. There's Thanksgiving, you know, there's Christmas and Hanukkah and Kwanzaa and New Year's. And so this tends to be the season where we may gather with family. And you know, I personally take it as a wonderful challenge in my own life. You know, I don't have any biological family left, but I got adopted by a family decades ago, and I spend Christmas with them. And there's one branch of the family who are very conservative Republican born again Christians, and I'm, you know, the gay leftist Buddhist teacher. You know, who shows up and they don't even know what to do with me. They love me. But so we have these enormous differences in terms of religion and politics, and yet we still love each other and we still keep connecting to each other, and sometimes it's hard. So, you know, one of the things I noticed, whether you are a child of parents who are still alive, or you're a parent of children, or if you have siblings, is that there's some way in which we kind of, with our family, we sort of get frozen in time. Have you noticed? Mm-hmm. You know, you go home and you've had all this life experience and there's been all this change and this depth, and they see you as, you know, the snotty-nosed 12-year-old. They don't see you for what you have become. And I think we do it as well. So is it possible... In terms of, now you may have a family where people are profoundly connected and loving and supportive and there's no problem at all. Or, you know, you may have a challenging family, and it's fine. If you have made the choice, and a number of people have, with family or with other intimates in your life, if you have said, you know what, I need some boundaries, I need some separation, it's fine if you have done that. It's fine if you choose not to have contact with your family at all. There are people who have made that choice, and it can be a healthy choice. But if you're willing to kind of reach over the boundaries and to stay connected to people you care about but who are very difficult, you can either react to the difficulty or you can take it as an opportunity. You know, it's this extraordinary opportunity to come to understand yourself better and to understand others better. Difficult relationships can be liberating. I was talking to someone recently in the Santa Fe Vipassana Sangha who said, who mentioned someone we both have known very well and said, that was the difficult person in my life, but they died. And I have a new boss who's taken that person's place. And I said, oh, how fortunate you are. You've got that teacher in your life. You know, when things are really easy, when relationships are really easy, we can get complacent. But when things are hard, that's when we really can show up with our practice. And again, what our practice is about is being aware and being kind. In every situation, trying to be aware of what's happening and trying to be kind in what's happening. It's amazing how it can work. So to be able to say to, I don't know, your uncle who is incredibly difficult and gets really drunk at the dinner table and is very, very hard, is really to say, how deeply can I understand this person? What can I find here? So we all have stories about each other, and we've all frozen each other in time with those stories. And to let go of your story about someone else and say, who's really here? And take a real interest. And if we take a real interest, that is the awareness part, you know, of actually this quality of inquiry. Who is this person? Why is all this happening? How can I understand this? The Buddha said to understand everything is to forgive everything. To come to understand people deeply and at the same time trying to understand our own process in reaction to people or in response to people, there's an amazing amount. It's at times can be at least as valuable as meditation. It's the same process. In meditation, we practice awareness and kindness. But the meditation is only like a laboratory for creating the strength of mind then to go forth into our lives and then really work our lives with awareness and kindness. So I think, you know, let's take the final exam. And it's okay if we fail. I keep failing. You know, even if it's an adopted family, it's so interesting to me. Here I am, you know, in my mid-60s, you know, with white hair, and people are treating me as if I were 25, you know, the person they knew when I was 25. And I find myself getting really regressed and reactive, you know. They're treating me that way. And I just noticed that, you know, and I realized, oh, I don't have to go back into that. I don't have to get stuck there. So it's this quality of being willing to turn toward what is happening. So we turn toward what is delightful and beautiful and joyous in our lives, but we're also willing to turn toward what is challenging in our lives. So thank you for your patience. Are there any questions? Or got one right away.
I have a question about dealing with with family, the final exam, and my role has always been to fix things, and they're so out of whack usually that I can't, and it makes me sad, so I withdraw and seem arrogant and probably feel arrogant. I don't know how to go toward the pain of others without re-experiencing my own and without somehow asking them why they're just cut it out. Just do something else. It's not helpful. Whatever.
So I'm going to give you a simple-minded response.
Thank you.
But I'm an introvert, and you know, an introvert who's sitting up here giving this talk, you know, it's the last thing that I normally would do. But as an introvert, I feel awkward in social situations. The most painful thing to me is to walk into a party. But I have found there are just two things that make it work. One is to smile warmly, and the other is to listen well. And I find that it works in every single social situation, including difficult family situations. You know, that I'm willing to be warm and kind to people, nothing lost by that, and then really listen to them. So it's not about my having things to say to them. I really want to take them in. I want to understand them. And people notice when you pay attention.
Right.
You know? They notice when you really want to understand them and to know them. And I have found that that really works. It works over and over and over again in all kinds of different situations. So if instead of fixing your family, you know, if you just go, smile warmly, listen well.
I could listen over the phone without smiling.
Basically what I'm talking about here with smiling warmly and listening well, the listening well is awareness, and the smiling warmly is the kindness. And so, smile over the phone. Good question. Thank you. Yes, please.
What if one of your family members exhibits and talks with the energy and the ideology that 60 years ago put people into cattle cars?
Right.
I've gotten angry. That goes nowhere. I withdraw. That goes nowhere. How do I hold it?
Again, I think I'm going to give you a simple answer. But it's very clear to me that people who are most angry and bitter are the people who need love most. You know, there's frozen, tight quality. And I have found that just surrounding someone with kindness and not being reactive, you know, there's some way in which some people feel that they can get attention by saying outrageous things, you know, that are very hurtful. Here's just one little principle that I have found so useful in terms of communication, skillful communication. One of the things we tend not to acknowledge out loud what we're feeling, and we tend not to acknowledge what other people are feeling. So if you have someone in your family who is stating the kinds of opinions that got people into cattle cars a couple of generations ago, it is simply to say, are you feeling anger right now? You know, are you feeling anger? And you know what? Always under the anger is fear. And they may not acknowledge the fear, but you can know that it's there. You know, and there's some way in which if you can acknowledge their anger and say, I see, not without reacting to it, I see that you're angry. There's some way through that, empathy. Do you remember what a big deal empathy was a few months ago when Sotomayor was up for, was nominated for the Supreme Court, and Obama said, I'm looking for people who have empathy, and it became this huge political issue. You know, it's like the empaths are going to take over the Supreme Court and undermine the whole process. Well, you know what? Empathy is a really good thing. You know, and so extending empathy even to people who are not pleasant, and you don't have to like someone to love them.
Right.
You know, and so you may still feel that dislike, but you can get beneath that, as it were, to love them. And my experience has been, you know, unless somebody is really a sociopath, they respond to
kindness.
Yeah, to kindness.
Thank you.
Sure.
Final.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, please.
I just want to share along the same line one experience I had last week. I was crossing the street at UNM, and I may have lingered a little bit more than crossing the street, diving on the top of it. There was a car coming, like a couple of teenagers blaring, playing. They, instead of stopping and letting me go, they kind of came right up to me and started yelling at me. What do you think you own the street and all that? And they were red and angry. And if I had not been doing this meditation, I would have reacted differently with some fingers and yelling back. But at that time, I felt so glad that they were suffering, actually. I saw that, you know? And I thought, how sad. I smiled and I just walked off. And I felt very good. Otherwise, it would have lingered for a long time. You know, I felt bad. And this guy yelled at me. Nothing.
Hmm.
I just went like that. I smiled and walked up because I saw the problem was with them, not me.
Just that distinction is extraordinarily valuable. You know, that essentially what we can do is, and you give a beautiful example of this, in that moment you had mastered your own mind. And so you weren't reactive. It's just what I've been talking about. So you weren't reactive to that situation, so you didn't suffer. And I think so much of the suffering comes when we're not clear that it's this mind and heart that needs to be worked, not what is happening to us. And so to see, okay, those people are suffering, and out of their suffering, they're doing hateful things. And to say, you know, that's not my responsibility. My responsibility is to respond in a non-reactive way. It's great. That's just what our practice is. Thank you. Good example.
What happened to the pterodactyl?
Well, I think, if I remember right, the pterodactyl was the question, if you didn't hear it, is what happened to the pterodactyl? The pterodactyl was flying along, and I think that when a dinosaur came lunging up out of the water to grab at the pterodactyl, that was when Miss Wormwood said, "Calvin, pay attention." So I think she was pretty much that dinosaur, you know, in his mind. And then he came out of the fantasy and dealt so skillfully with her that she was left speechless. Anything else? Any other comments or questions about this subject? I just want to make one announcement, and that is that I'll be coming back on December 3rd to give a talk, and that's going to be actually the last time for years and years now. I've come once a month to Albuquerque to give a talk and to offer interviews or discussions about practice. Meetings about practice, and we're changing that. After December, I'll be coming for a 2-4 week series. I'll be here every Thursday in March, and every Thursday for 4 weeks in late October and through the first 3 weeks of November next year. So just to say that format is changing. Thanks so much.